arrogantly, sometimes viciously, and with no tenderness or humour, and the Marquis had thought that the elephant was stupid. He had even believed that there was no way that the elephant would correctly identify his role in the disappearance of the diary. It had been a long time ago, though, when the Marquis was young and foolish. This whole spending years training up a guide to betray me just on the off chance I'd come along and hire her, said the Marquis. Isn't that a bit of an overreaction?
Not if you know me, said the elephant. If you know me, it's pretty mild. I did lots of other things to find you too.
The Marquis tried to sit up. The elephant pushed him back to the floor with one bare foot.
Beg for mercy, said the elephant.
That one was easy.
Mercy, said the Marquis. I beg, I plead, show me mercy, the finest of all gifts. It befits you, mighty elephant, as lord of your own domain, to be merciful to one who is not even fit to wipe the dust from your excellent toes.
Did you know, said the elephant, that everything you say sounds sarcastic?
I didn't. I apologize. I meant every single word of it.
Scream, said the elephant.
The Marquis de Carabas screamed very loudly and very long. It is hard to scream when your throat has been recently cut, but he screamed as hard and piteously as he could.
You even scream sarcastically, said the elephant.
There was a large black cast-iron pipe jutting out from the wall. A wheel in the side of the pipe allowed whatever came out of the pipe to be turned on and turned off. The elephant hauled on it with powerful arms, and a trickle of dark sludge came out, followed by a spurt of water.
Drainage overflow, said the elephant. Now, thing is, I do my homework. You keep your life well hidden, De Carabas. You have done all these years since you and I first crossed paths. No point in even trying anything as long as you had your life elsewhere. I've had people all over London below. People you've eaten with, people you've slept with or laughed with, or wound up naked in the clock tower of Big Ben with. But there was never any point in taking it further. Not as long as your life was still carefully tucked out of harm's way. Until last week, when the word under the street was that your life was out of its box. And that was when I put the word out, that I'd give the freedom of the castle to the first person to let me see
me scream for mercy, said De Carabas. You said.
You interrupted me,
said the elephant, mildly.
I was going to give the freedom of the castle to the first person to let me see your dead body.
He pulled the wheel the rest of the way, and the spurt of water became a gush.
I ought to warn you, there is, said De Carabas, a curse on the hand of anyone who kills me.
I'll take the curse, said the elephant, although you're probably making it up. You'll like the next bit. The room fills with water, and then you drown. Then I let the water out, and I come in, and I laugh a lot.
He made a trumpeting noise that might, De Carabas reflected, have been a laugh if you were an elephant. The elephant stepped out of De Carabas' line of sight. The Marquis heard a door bang. He was lying in a puddle. He writhed and wriggled, then got to his feet. He looked down. There was a metal cuff around his ankle, which was chained to a metal pole in the center of the room. He wished he were wearing his coat. There were blades in his coat. There were picklocks. There were buttons that were nowhere nearly as innocent and button-like as they appeared to be. He rubbed the rope that bound his wrists against the metal pole, hoping to make it fray, feeling the skin of his wrists and palms rubbing off even as the rope absorbed the water and tightened about him. The water level continued to rise. Already it was up to his waist. Dekarabas looked about the circular chamber. All he had to do was free himself from the bonds that tied his wrists, obviously by loosening the pole to which he was bound, and then he would open the cuff around his ankle, turn off the water, get out of the room, avoid a revenge-driven elephant and any of his assorted thugs, and get away. He tugged on the pole. It didn't move. He tugged on it harder. It didn't move some more. He slumped against the pole, and he thought about death, a true, final death, and he thought about his coat. A voice whispered in his ear. It said, "Quiet!" Something tugged at his wrists, and his bonds fell away. It was only as life came back into his wrists that he realized how tightly he had been bound. He turned around. He said, "What?" The face that met his was as familiar as his own. The smile was devastating. The eyes were guileless and adventuresome. "Ankle," said the man, with a new smile that was even more devastating than the previous one. The Marquis de Carabas was not devastated. He raised his leg, and the man reached down, did something with a piece of wire, and removed the leg cuff. "I heard you were having a spot of bother," said the man. His skin was as dark as the Marquis's own. He was less than an inch taller than de Carabas, but he held himself as if he were easily taller than anyone he was ever likely to meet. "No, no bother, I'm fine," said the Marquis. "You aren't. I just rescued you." De Carabas ignored this. "Where's the elephant?" "On the other side of that door, with a number of the people working for him. The doors lock automatically when the hall is filled with water. He needed to be certain that he wouldn't be trapped in here with you. It was what I was counting on." "Counting on?" "Of course. I'd been following them for several hours, ever since I heard that you'd gone off with one of the elephant's plants. I thought, bad move. I thought he'll be needing a hand with that." "You heard?" "Look," said the man, who looked a little like the Marquis de Carabas, only he was taller, and perhaps some people, not the Marquis, obviously, might have thought him just a hair more attractive. "You don't think I was going to let anything happen to my little brother, did you?" They were up to their waists in water. "I was fine," said de Carabas. "I had it all under control." The man walked over to the far end of the room. He knelt down, fumbled in the water, then from his backpack he produced something that looked like a short crowbar. He pushed one end of it beneath the surface of the water. "Get ready," he said. "I think this should be our quickest way out of here." The Marquis was still flexing his pins and needles, cramping fingers, trying to rub life back into them. "What is it?" he said, trying to sound unimpressed. The man said, "There we go," and pulled up a large square of metal. "It's the drain." De Carabas did not have a chance to protest as his brother picked him up and dropped him down a hole in the floor. "Probably," thought de Carabas, "there are rides like this at fun fairs." He could imagine them. Upworlders might pay good money to take this ride if they were certain they would survive it. He crashed through pipes, swept along by the flow of water, always heading down and deeper. He was not certain he was going to survive the ride, and he was not having fun. The Marquis's body was bruised and battered as he rode the water down the pipe. He tumbled out face down onto a large metal grate, which seemed scarcely able to hold his weight. He crawled off the grate onto the rock floor beside it, and he shivered. There was an unlikely sort of a noise, and it was immediately followed by his brother, who shot out of the pipe and landed on his feet as if he'd been practicing. He smiled. Fun, eh? Not really, said the Marquis de Carabas. And then he had to ask. Were you just going, wee? Of course. Weren't you? Asked his brother. De Carabas got to his feet unsteadily. He said only, what are you calling yourself these days? Still the same. I don't change. It's not your real name, Peregrine, said De Carabas. It'll do. It marks my territory and my intentions. You're still calling yourself a marquis then, said Peregrine. I am because I say I am, said the marquis. He looked, he was sure, like a drowned thing, and sounded, he was certain, unconvincing. He felt small and foolish. Your choice. Anyway, I'm off. You don't need me any more. Stay out of trouble. You don't actually have to thank me. His brother meant it, of course. That was what stung the hardest. The Marquis de Carabas hated himself. He hadn't wanted to say it, but now it had to be said. Thank you, Peregrine. Oh, said Peregrine, your coat. Word on the street is it wound up in Shepherd's Bush. That's all I know. So, advice. Mean this most sincerely. I know you don't like advice, but the coat? Let it go. Forget about it. Just get a new coat. Honest. Well then, said the Marquis. Well, said Peregrine, and he grinned and shook himself like a dog, spraying water everywhere, before he slipped into the shadows and was gone. The Marquis de Carabas stood and dripped balefully. He had a little time before the elephant discovered the lack of water in the room and the lack of a body, and came looking for him. He checked his shirt pocket. The sandwich bag was there, and the envelope appeared safe and dry inside it. He wondered for a moment about something that had bothered him since the market. Why would the mushroom lad use him, de Carabas, to send a letter to the fair Drusilla? And what kind of letter could persuade a member of the Raven's Court, and one with a star on her hand at that, to give up her life at the court and love one of the mushroom folk? A suspicion occurred to him. It was not a comfortable idea, nor a charitable one, but it was swept aside by more immediate problems. He could hide, lie low, for a while. All this would pass. But there was the coat to think about. He had been rescued. Rescued! By his brother! Something that would never have happened under normal circumstances. He could get a new coat. Of course he could. But it would not be his coat. A shepherd had his coat. The Marquis de Carabas always had a plan, and he always had a fallback plan, and beneath these plans he always had a real plan, one that he would not even let himself know about, for when the original plan and the fallback plan had both gone south. Now, it pained him to admit to himself, he had no plan. He did not even have a normal, boring, obvious plan that he could abandon as soon as things got tricky. He just had a want, and it drove him as their need for food or love or safety drove those the Marquis considered lesser men. He was planless. He just wanted his coat back. The Marquis de Carabas began walking. He had an envelope containing a love poem in his pocket. He was wrapped in a damp blanket, and he hated his brother for rescuing him. When you create yourself from scratch, you need a model of some kind, something to aim towards or head away from, all the things you want to be or intentionally want not to be. The Marquis had known whom he had wanted not to be when he was a boy. He had definitely not wanted to be like Peregrine. He had not wanted to be like anyone at all. He had instead wanted to be elegant, elusive, brilliant. And above all things, he had wanted to be unique. Just like Peregrine. The thing was, he had been told, by a former shepherd on the run, whom he had helped across the Tyburn River to freedom and to a short but happy life as a camp entertainer for the Roman legion who waited there beside the river for orders that would never come, that the shepherds never made you do anything. They just took your natural impulses and desires, and they pushed them, reinforced them, so you acted quite naturally, only you acted in the ways that they wanted. He remembered that, and then he forgot it, because he was scared of being alone. The Marquis had not known until just this moment quite how scared he was of being alone, and was surprised by how happy he was to see several other people walking in the same direction as he was. "I'm glad you're here," one of them called. "I'm glad you're here," called another. "I'm glad I'm here too," said De Carabas. Where was he going? Where were they going? So good that they were all traveling the same way together. There was safety in numbers. "It's good to be together," said a thin white woman with a happy sort of a sigh. And it was. "It's good to be together," said the Marquis.
"Indeed it is. It's good to be together," said his neighbour on the other side.
There was something familiar about this person. He had huge ears, like fans, and a nose like a thick, grey-green snake. The Marquis began to wonder if he had ever met this person before, and was trying to remember exactly where, when he was tapped gently on the shoulder by a man holding a large stick with a curved end. "We never want to fall out of step, do we?" said the man, reasonably, and the Marquis thought, "Of course we don't," and he sped up a little, so he was back in step once more.
"That's good. Out of step is out of mind," said the man with the stick, and he moved on.
"Out of step is out of mind," said the Marquis, aloud, wondering how he could have missed knowing something so obvious, so basic. There was a tiny part of him, somewhere distant, that wondered what that actually meant. They reached the place they were going, and it was good to be among friends. Time passed strangely in that place, but soon enough the Marquis and his friend with the grey-green face and the long nose were given a job to do, a real job, and it was this. They disposed of those members of the flock who could no longer move or serve, once anything that might be of use had been removed and reused. They removed the last of what was left, hair and tallow fat and all. Then they dragged them to the pit and dropped the remnants in. The shifts were long and tiring, and the work was messy, but the two of them did it together, and they stayed in step. They had been working proudly together for several days when the Marquis noticed an irritant. Someone appeared to be trying to attract his attention.
"I followed you," whispered the stranger. "I know you didn't want me to, but, well, needs must."
The Marquis did not know what the stranger was talking about.
"I've got an escape plan as soon as I can wake you up," said the stranger. "Please wake up."
The Marquis was awake. Again, he found he did not know what the stranger was talking about. Why did the man think he was asleep? The Marquis would have said something, but he had to work. He pondered this while dismembering the next former member of the flock, until he decided that there was something he could say to explain why the stranger was irritating him. He said it aloud. "It's good to work," said the Marquis. His friend, with the long, flexible nose and the huge ears, nodded his head at this. They worked. After a while, his friend hauled what was left of some former members of the flock over to the pit and pushed them in. The pit went down a long way. The Marquis tried to ignore the stranger, who was now standing behind him. He was quite put out when he felt something slapped over his mouth and his hands being bound together behind his back. He was not certain what he was meant to do. It made him feel quite out of step with the flock, and he would have complained, would have called out to his friend, but his lips were now stuck together, and he was unable to do more than make ineffectual noises. "It's me," whispered the voice from behind him, urgently. "Peregrine, your brother. You've been captured by the shepherds. We have to get you out of here." And then, uh-oh. A noise in the air, like something barking. It came closer, a high yip-yipping that turned suddenly into a triumphant howl and was answered by matching howls from around them. A voice barked, "Where's your flock, mate?" A low elephantine voice rumbled,
"He went over there with the other one."
"Other one?"
The Marquis hoped they would come and find him and sort this all out. There was obviously some sort of mistake going on. He wanted to be in step with the flock, and now he was out of step, an unwilling victim. He wanted to work.
"Lud's Gate," muttered Peregrine,
and then they were surrounded by the shapes of people who were not exactly people. They were sharp of face and dressed in furs. They spoke excitedly to each other. The people untied the Marquis's hands, although they left the tape on his face. He did not mind. He had nothing to say. The Marquis was relieved it was all over and looked forward to getting back to work, but to his slight puzzlement, he, his kidnapper, and his friend with the huge, long, flexible nose, walked away from the pit, along a causeway, and eventually into a honeycomb of little rooms, each room filled with people toiling away in step. Up some narrow stairs, one of their escorts, dressed in rough furs, scratched at a door. A voice called, "Enter!" And the Marquis felt a thrill that was almost sexual. That voice. That was the voice of someone the Marquis had spent his whole life wanting to please. His whole life went back what? A week? 2 weeks?
"A stray lamb," said one of the escorts, "and his predator, also his flockmate."
The room was large and hung with oil paintings, landscapes mostly, stained with age and smoke and dust. "Why," said the man sitting at a desk in the back of the room. He did not turn around. "Why do you bother me with this nonsense?" "Because," said a voice, and the Marquis recognized it as that of his would-be kidnapper. "You gave orders that if ever I were to be apprehended within the bounds of the shepherd's bush, I was to be brought to you to dispose of personally." The man pushed his chair back and got up. He walked towards them, stepping into the light. There was a wooden crook propped against the wall, and he picked it up as he passed. For several long moments, he looked at them. "Peregrine," he said at last, and the Marquis thrilled at his voice. "I had heard that you had gone into retirement, become a monk or something. I never dreamed you'd dare to come back." Something very big was filling the Marquis's head. Something was filling his heart and his mind. It was something enormous, something he could almost touch. The shepherd reached out a hand and ripped the tape from the Marquis's mouth. The Marquis knew he should have been overjoyed by this, should have been thrilled to get attention from this man.
"And now I see. Who would have thought it?"
The shepherd's voice was deep and resonant.
"He is here already, and already one of ours, the Marquis de Carabas. You know, Peregrine, I had been looking forward to ripping out your tongue, to grinding your fingers away while you watched, but think how much more delightful it would be if the last thing you ever saw was your own brother, one of our flock, as the instrument of your doom."
An enormous thing filled the Marquis's head. The shepherd was plump, well-fed, and was excellently dressed. He had sandy grey-coloured hair and a harassed expression. He wore a remarkable coat, even if it was somewhat tight on him. The coat was the colour of a wet street at midnight. The enormous thing filling his head, the Marquis realised, was rage.
It was rage, and it burned through the Marquis like a forest fire, devouring everything in its path with a red flame.
The coat. It was elegant. It was beautiful. It was so close that he could have reached out and touched it. And it was unquestionably his. The Marquis de Carabas did nothing to indicate that he had woken up. That would have been a mistake. He thought, and he thought fast, and what he thought had nothing to do with the room he was in. The Marquis had only one advantage over the shepherd and his dogs. He knew he was awake and in control of his thoughts, and they did not. He hypothesized. He tested his hypothesis in his head, and then he acted.
"Excuse me," he said blandly, "but I'm afraid I do need to be getting along. Can we hurry this up? I'm late for something that's frightfully important."
The shepherd leaned on his crook. He did not appear to be concerned by this. He said only,
"You've left the flock, de Carabas."
"It would appear so," said the Marquis. "Hello, Peregrine. Wonderful to see you looking so sprightly. And the elephant! How delightful! The gang's all here."
He turned his attention back to the shepherd.
"Wonderful meeting you. Delightful to spend a modicum of time as one of your little band of serious thinkers. But I really must be tootling off now. Important diplomatic mission. Letter to deliver. You know how it is."
Peregrine said,
"My brother, I'm not sure that you understand the gravity of the situation here."
The Marquis, who understood the gravity of the situation perfectly, said,
"I'm sure these nice people..."
He gestured to the shepherd and to the three fur-clad, sharp-faced sheepdog people who were standing about them.
"Will let me head out of here, leaving you behind. It's you they want, not me, and I have something extremely important to deliver."
Peregrine said, "I can handle this."
"You have to be quiet now," said the shepherd.
He took the strip of tape he had removed from the Marquis's mouth and pressed it down over Peregrine's. The shepherd was shorter than the Marquis and fatter, and the magnificent coat looked faintly ridiculous on him.
"Something important to deliver?"
asked the shepherd, brushing dust from his fingers.
"What exactly are we talking about here?"
"I'm afraid I cannot possibly tell you that," said the Marquis. "You are, after all, not the intended recipient of this particular diplomatic communique."
"Why not? What's it say? Who's it for?"
The Marquis shrugged. His coat was so close that he could have reached out and stroked it.
"Only the threat of death could force me even to show it to you," he said reluctantly. "Well, that's easy. I threaten you with death.
That's in addition to the death sentence you're already under as an apostate member of the flock. And as for Laughing Boy here... The shepherd gestured with his crook towards Peregrine, who was not laughing. He's tried to steal a member of the flock. That's a death sentence too, in addition to everything else we're planning to do to him. The shepherd looked at the elephant. And I know I should have asked before, but what in the old witch's name is this?
I am a loyal member of the flock, said the elephant, humbly, in his deep voice,
and the Marquis wondered if he had himself sounded so soulless and flat when he had been part of the flock.
I have remained loyal and in step, even when this one did not.
And the flock is grateful for all your hard work, said the shepherd. He reached out a hand and touched the sharp tip of one elephantine tusk experimentally.
I've never seen anything like you before, and if I never see another one again, it'll be too soon. Probably best if you die too.
The elephant's ears twitched.
But I am of the flock.
The shepherd looked up into the elephant's huge face.
Better safe than sorry, he said.
Then to the Marquis,
well, where is this important letter?
The Marquis de Carabas said, it is inside my shirt. I must repeat that it is the most significant document that I have ever been charged to deliver. I must ask you not to look at it, for your own safety. The shepherd tugged at the front of the Marquis's shirt. The buttons flew and rattled off the walls onto the floor. The letter, in its sandwich bag, was in the pocket inside the shirt.
This is most unfortunate. I trust you will read it aloud to us before we die, said the Marquis. But whether or not you read it to us, I can promise that Peregrine and I will be holding our breath.
Won't we, Peregrine? The shepherd opened the sandwich bag. Then he looked at the envelope. He ripped it open and pulled a sheet of discolored paper from inside it. Dust came from the envelope as the paper came out. The dust hung in the still air in that dim room.
My darling, beautiful Drusilla, read the shepherd aloud. While I know that you do not presently feel about me as I feel about you...
What is this nonsense?
The Marquis said nothing. He did not even smile. He was, as he had stated, holding his breath. He was hoping that Peregrine had listened to him, and he was counting because at that moment counting seemed like the best possible thing that he could do to distract himself from needing to breathe. He would soon need to breathe. 35. 36. 37. He wondered how long mushroom spores remained in the air. 43, 44, 45, 46. The shepherd had stopped speaking. The Marquis took a step backward, fearing a knife in his ribs or teeth in his throat from the rough-furred guard dog men, but there was nothing. He walked backward, away from the dog men and the elephant. He saw that Peregrine was also walking backward. His lungs hurt. His heart was pounding in his temples, pounding almost loudly enough to drown out the thin ringing noise in his ears. Only when the Marquis's back was against a bookcase on the wall, and he was as far as he could possibly get from the envelope, did he allow himself to take a deep breath. He heard Peregrine breathe in too. There was a stretching noise. Peregrine opened his mouth wide, and the tape dropped to the ground.
What, asked Peregrine, was all that about?
Our way out of this room and our way out of Shepherd's Bush, if I am not mistaken, said de Carabas, as I so rarely am. Would you mind unbinding my wrists? He felt Peregrine's hands on his bound hands, and then the bindings fell away. There was a low rumbling.
"I'm going to kill somebody," said the elephant. "As soon as I figure out who."
"Whoa, dear heart," said the Marquis, rubbing his hands together. "You mean whom?" The shepherd and the sheepdogs were taking awkward experimental steps towards the door. "And I can assure you that you aren't going to kill anybody, not as long as you want to get home to the castle safely." The elephant's trunk swished irritably.
"I'm definitely going to kill you."
The Marquis grinned. "You are going to force me to say pshaw," he said, "or fiddlesticks. Until this moment, I have never had the slightest yearning to say fiddlesticks, but I can feel it right now, welling up inside me."
"What, by the temple and the arch, has got into you?"
asked the elephant. "Wrong question, but I shall ask the right question on your behalf. The question is actually, what hasn't got into the three of us? It hasn't got into Peregrine and me, because we were holding our breath. It hasn't got into you because, I don't know, probably because you're an elephant with nice thick skin, more likely because you were breathing through your trunk, which is down at ground level. And what did get into our captors? And the answer is, what hasn't got into us are the self-same spores that have got into our portly shepherd and his pseudo-canine companions."
"Spores of the mushroom?" asked Peregrine. "The mushroom people's the mushroom."
"Indeed, that self-same mushroom," agreed the Marquis.
"Blimmin' heck,"
said the elephant. "Which is why," Decarabus told the elephant, "if you attempt to kill me, or to kill Peregrine, you will not only fail, but you will doom us all. Whereas if you shut up, and we all do our best to look as if we are still part of the flock, then we have a chance. The spores will be threading their way into their brains now, and any moment now, the mushroom will begin calling them home." A shepherd walked implacably. He held a wooden crook. Three men followed him. One of those men had the head of an elephant. One was tall and ridiculously handsome, and the last of the flock wore a most magnificent coat. It fit him perfectly, and it was the colour of a wet street at night. The flock was followed by guard dogs, who moved as if they were ready to walk through fire to get wherever they believed that they were going. It was not unusual in Shepherd's Bush to see a shepherd and part of his flock moving from place to place, accompanied by several of the fiercest sheepdogs, who were human, or had been once. So when they saw a shepherd and three sheepdogs apparently leading three members of the flock away from Shepherd's Bush, none of the greater flock paid them any mind. The members of the flock who saw them simply did the same things they had always done, as members of the flock. And if they were aware that the influence of the shepherds had waned a little, then they patiently waited for another shepherd to come and to take care of them and to keep them safe from predators and from the world. It was a scary thing to be alone, after all. Nobody noticed as they crossed the bounds of Shepherd's Bush, and still they kept on walking. The seven of them reached the banks of the Kilburn, where they stopped, and the former shepherd and the three shaggy dog men strode out into the water. There was, the Marquis knew, nothing in the four men's heads at that moment but a need to get to the mushroom, to taste its flesh once more, to let it live inside them, to serve it and to serve it well. In exchange, the mushroom would fix all the things about themselves that they hated. It would make their interior lives much happier and more interesting.
"Should have let me kill him,"
said the elephant, as the former shepherd and sheepdogs waded away. "No point," said the Marquis. Not even for revenge. The people who captured us don't exist any longer. The elephant flapped his ears hard, then scratched them vigorously.
Talking about revenge, who the hell did you steal my diary for anyway?
He asked. Victoria, admitted the Carabus.
Not actually on my list of potential thieves. She's a deep one, said the elephant after a moment.
I'll not argue with that, said the Marquis. Also, she failed to pay me the entire amount agreed. I wound up obtaining my own lagniappe to make up the deficit. He reached a dark hand into the inside of his coat. His fingers found the obvious pockets and the less obvious, and then, to his surprise, the least obvious of all. He reached inside it and pulled out a magnifying glass on a chain. It was Victoria's, he said. I believe you can use it to see through solid things. Perhaps this could be considered a small payment against my debt to you. The elephant took something out of its own pocket, the Marquis could not see what it was, and squinted at it through the magnifying glass. Then the elephant made a noise halfway between a delighted snort and a trumpet of satisfaction.
Oh, fine, very fine, it said.
It pocketed both of the objects.
Then it said, I suppose that saving my life outranks stealing my diary. And while I wouldn't have needed saving if I hadn't followed you down the drain, further recriminations are pointless. Consider your life your own once more.
I look forward to visiting you in the castle some day, said the Marquis.
Don't push your luck, mate, said the elephant, with an irritable swish of his trunk.
I won't, said the Marquis, resisting the urge to point out that pushing his luck was the only way he had made it this far. He looked around and realized that Peregrine had slipped mysteriously and irritatingly away into the shadows once more without so much as a goodbye. The Marquis hated it when people did that. He made a small courtly bow to the elephant. And the Marquis's coat, his glorious coat, caught the bow, amplified it, made it perfect, and made it the kind of bow that only the Marquis de Carabas could ever possibly make, whoever he was. The next floating market was being held in Derry and Tom's roof garden. There had been no Derry and Tom's since 1973, but time and space and London below had their own uncomfortable agreement, and the roof garden was younger and more innocent than it is today. The folk from London above, they were young and in an intense discussion, and they had stacked heels and paisley tops and bell-bottom flares, the men and the women, ignored the folk from London below entirely. The Marquis de Carabas strode through the roof garden as if he owned the place, walking swiftly until he reached the food court. He passed a tiny woman selling curling cheese sandwiches from a wheelbarrow piled high with the things. A curry stall, a short man with a huge glass bowl of pale white blind fish, and a toasting fork. Until finally he reached the stall that was selling the mushroom.
"Slice of the mushroom, well grilled, please," said the Marquis de Carabas.
The man who took his order was shorter than he was, and still somewhat stouter. He had sandy, receding hair and a harried expression.
"Coming right up," said the man. "Anything else?"
"No, that's all."
And then, curiously, the Marquis asked, "Do you remember me?"
"I am afraid not," said the mushroom man, "but I must say that is a most beautiful coat."
"Thank you," said the Marquis de Carabas. He looked around. "Where is the young fellow who used to work here?"
"Ah, that is a most curious story, sir," said the man.
He did not yet smell of damp, although there was a small encrustation of mushrooms on the side of his neck. I am informed that somebody told the fair Drusilla of the court of the Raven that our Vince had designs upon her, and had, you may not credit it, but I am assured that it is so, apparently sent her a letter filled with spores, with the intention of making her his bride in the mushroom. The Marquis raised an eyebrow quizzically, although he found none of this surprising. He had, after all, told Drusilla himself, and had even shown her the original letter. Did she take well to the news?
I do not believe that she did, sir. I do not believe that she did. She and several of her sisters were waiting for Vince, and they all caught up with us on our way to the market. She told him they had matters to discuss of an intimate nature. He seemed delighted by this news, and went off with her, to find out what these matters were. I have been waiting for him to arrive at the market and come and work all evening, but I no longer believe he will be coming.
Then the man said, a little wistfully,
"That is a very fine coat. It seems to me that I might have had one like it, in a former life."
"I do not doubt it," said the Marquis de Carabas, satisfied with what he had heard cutting into his grilled slice of the mushroom. "But this particular coat is most definitely mine."
As he made his way out of the market, he passed a clump of people descending the stairs, and he paused and nodded at a young woman of uncommon grace. She had the long orange hair and the flattened profile of a Pre-Raphaelite beauty, and there was a birthmark in the shape of a five-pointed star on the back of one hand. Her other hand was stroking the head of a large rumpled owl, which glared uncomfortably out at the world with eyes that were, unusually for such a bird, of an intense pale blue. The Marquis nodded at her, and she glanced awkwardly at him. Then she looked away in the manner of someone who had just begun to realize that she owed the Marquis a favor. He nodded at her amiably, and continued to descend. Drusilla hurried after him. She looked as if she had something she wanted to say. The Marquis de Carabas reached the foot of the stairs ahead of her. He stopped for a moment, and he thought about people and about things and about how hard it is to do anything for the first time. And then, clad in his fine coat, he slipped mysteriously, even irritatingly, into the shadows, without so much as a goodbye, and he was gone.
This recording was produced and directed by Rick Harris. It was recorded at Harper Audio Studios by Sharon Matlin and Lance Neal. It was edited by InFX Productions. Mixing and mastering were by Angela Paiva. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.